This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, maps, footnotes, and dedications. When authors go the extra mile.
Now, this week is inspired by a question that Jules has about whether she's the only one who reads literally everything in the book. Now, I know that there must be other crazy people out there who do the same thing, but I'm inclined to say, yes, Jules, you are the only one.
Thank you for making me sound like a complete nerd.
No, I actually do as well. I mean, I will sometimes, you know, skip right the little bits at the end. But yeah, I think that when an author goes that extra mile and adds little bits and bobs throughout, it can be a little adventure unto itself, kind of picking them all out and discovering them.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly if it's a book that you've enjoyed as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's start with... this is such a weird thing to say, considering that we've been going for nearly 3 years and we talk about specific books and specific plots and stories and things, but we've never talked about the book as an object.
No, we haven't. So this is a good time to actually breach that subject.
Yeah, I have to admit, I read an all... Because I get through a couple of hundred books a year, most of my books are read on e-reader. Mm. Or via audiobook. And obviously you don't hold either of those in your hand in the same way as you would, say, a hardback or a paperback, which can be lovely objects that are basically art in their own rights. Seriously, getting through sort of 200 books a year, I cannot physically afford to have that much space in my house taken up. Alan would go absolutely mad, for one thing. And he's a book lover, but this is a case of, no, you're taking up too much space. You're bursting out of your own study now. And there is a cost element as well. So I tend to only buy hard copies of books that I love and know I will read and reread and reread again. Yeah. Or if there's something that's so utterly exquisite that I think is, that, you know, I will treasure and reread, then I might buy a hard copy then. But I'm far more likely to have read a book by ebook first or audiobook and then gone, no, I actually really want a hard copy of that one.
Yeah. And I'm much the same also because I travel a lot. Having ebooks is just so useful. And it's great because you can have a whole list of books or journals or whatever all on demand as you want, wherever you are, without having to... Because in the past, it was the same with my mother. We'd have to have entire suitcase dedicated to the books that we'd be bringing on holiday because she would just gobble them up. So I think it's revolutionary. And I think that people who kind of sneer... don't realise actually how useful they are. But I do agree, there is something to be said about having a physical copy. And actually recently I invested in some hardback covers. I didn't have that many. I had some hardback covers of some of the classics. So I had hardback covers of Picture of Dorian Gray and Jane Austen and Arthur Conan Doyle and those kinds of things. But up until this point, I didn't really have any hardback copy books which I children's books in particular, or YA or popular modern books, and that all changed when I discovered the special edition hardback copy of Six of Crows, and I was actually in Ireland at the time when I saw it in a bookshop. And I was just salivating over it, knowing full well I didn't have the room in my suitcase or the weight. I was in my suitcase, I couldn't take it back with me, and I was just looking at it longingly and thinking, I will get that because I love the book, and it was such a beautiful cover, and the inside has got artwork, and it's just so gorgeous.
Yeah,
And then, to my surprise, my partner Sean bought it for me. When we got back to England, he ordered it for me and gave it to me. And I was so happy. And then a few weeks later, I came across the hardback copies of The Lies of Lochlann Mora, Red Seas Under Red Skies, and The Republic of Thieves, and I just had to have them. So now I guess I've started a collection of my absolute favorite books, because I think it's not just that they'll last longer. They are There's a presence about it. There's a level of importance, that makes you think this is a story that is worthwhile, that I will come back to and that I cherish.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been collecting the Penguin Clothbound classic, Jane Austen, the Brontes, Wilkie Collins, all the sort of 19th century classics that I quite frequently bring up, that I've loved all my life. And I know that you can get most of them for free on Kindle, and I know that you can get cheap 99p paperback versions of them. And I've actually gone through several cheap paperback versions and not so cheap paperback versions of these books, and it's just a case of no, I'd actually really like a really, really nice copy. So it started with, weirdly again, it started with Alan buying me a book a few years ago. We were in Waterstones and I saw the cloth-bound Penguin edition of Les Misérables, which is one of my favourite books, and he just said, "Well, do you want it?" And I said, "Well, I know I can get it for free on Kindle." And it's like, "Well, no, if you really like it." So he bought me a copy of Les Misérables as this lovely edition in cloth bound. And now I'm kind of with those books. It's a case of, right, they don't go anywhere near the bath. They don't get taken out of the house. I don't eat with them. There might be a cup of tea nearby, but the tea is kind of segregated on a separate part of the table.
It must be said, I think if any book needs to be hardback, it's probably Miserable. I just remember seeing it in a bookstore and going, huh, and I went to pick it up and I thought that I was picking up two books, but no, it was just one that kept going. And then I opened it and the writing was tiny. And I was like, my God, you need a bigger.
It is kind of like the the very thin paper, the way with the tiny, tiny print that you used to get in the old Bibles, where they were really, really eking out the paper to make it all fit in. I mean, this is obviously good paper, but it's again tiny, tiny print, so I don't care. I love them anyway. But I mean, that's the point, isn't it? A book, just the act of holding a physical copy of something that you really love, it's an intensely pleasurable experience. So yes, I love what we can do with independently publishing books now, and I love the fact that there are less gatekeepers in that respect. So as long as an author goes through, try and produce something of good standard and then looks out for readers. I read a lot of indie authors as well. I think it's great that things are much more accessible in that respect, because it's sort of pushed the industry to be more inclusive in other ways and a lot faster than it would have done. But on the other hand, there is just something about holding a hardback copy of a book that you love.
There is.
I mean, I don't even like the Lies of Lochlann Mora series as much as you do, but I looked at those photos and I'm like, well, they're gorgeous, gorgeous books, clearly. Same with Sydney Prose.
The moment I got the hard covers, I just photo shoot.
But I mean, I quite like doing that as well.
It's a very nerdy thing to do, but I do like Bookstagram. I do like taking pictures of books. And yeah, when you have very nice covers, it's just a pleasure, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And that's what I like Instagram for, basically. I'm not interested in anything else. I just want to see pictures of people's books and bookshelves.
Show me your books. What? Show me your books. What about my picture? My cat. You may show me a cat, but also show me the
Yeah, book, cat, and cup of tea together. That's like the trifecta
books.
for me.
That's heaven.
So, moving on to more sort of the inside of the books, things like dedications, epigraphs, acknowledgements, author notes. Does anybody else read pretty much all of that? Because I do. I'm interested in dedications. If an author manages to say something funny in a dedication, they've sort of half won me over already. Obviously, dedications are very personal to who they're for. But things like epigraphs, I really, really like an epigraph, as you might have noticed on my books, or maybe you skipped that part entirely. Which is absolutely fine, because the whole point of an epigraph is to give you a quote of something else that suggests part of the theme of the book without giving it away. And I put them in because I love them, but, you know, obviously it's not for everyone.
I'm not sure. Sometimes I'll read the epigraph or the author note at the end. But I will almost always read the dedication. And I think authors can be very clever with their dedications, and also very sweet. And I think that actually to ignore the dedication is not an insult, but when you think about it, the dedication is there to sort of present the book as a gift. Yeah. And it's presenting it as a gift in a very public way to say, I want everyone to know that this was for you and the impact that you have had on my life or on the book or whatever. So I feel like you should read the dedication.
Yeah, I just started The Weight of Our Stars by Kay Ankrum, and there's a great dedication in the front of the book that, actually, hang on a second, let me just see if I can pull that up, because that one's actually worth reading out. It did make me laugh, but it was also kind of like, yeah, I kind of get where you're coming from there. Oh, we have a surprise guest. My cat has just come in.
Hello.
She hasn't leapt up on me yet, but, you know, if you hear purring, it's not me, it's the cat. Okay, yes. So, from The Weight of Our Stars by Kay Ankrum, this book is for all of us who looked up at the sky in wonder and then cried when we learned how much calculus separated us from the stars.
Aww.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm not actually particularly bad at maths, but I'm nowhere near kind of astronaut level or as good as you've got to be for that. So yeah, I totally feel your pain there.
I'm trying to think of some. I've seen some great dedications online.
Yeah, I've got a list here actually. There's this is My Shit Life So Far by Frankie Boyle. Mm-hmm. To all my enemies, I will destroy you.
Yes, and there's another one which was to that guy who yelled at me in the supermarket when I was a child. You, sir, are an asshole.
Yeah, and then there's Austin Land by Shannon Hale. For Colin Firth, you're a really great guy, but I'm married, so I think we should just be friends.
And I do like it when authors dedicate it to people who will probably never see or even know. They are.
This is quite a good one as well. An Introduction to Algebraic Topology by Joseph J. Rotman to my wife, Marginit, and my children, Ella Rose and Daniel Adam, without whom this book would have been completed 2 years earlier. So, yeah, that's there are some really, really great ones. Oh, right. Here you go. This is The Land of Stories by Chris Colfer. To Grandma, for being my first editor and giving me the best writing advice I've ever received. Christopher, I think you should wait until you're done with elementary school before worrying about being a failed writer. If that's a true story, that is brilliant.
To be honest, I could totally imagine that advice being given to you, Jules.
I don't think I had sort of existential, I'm a failed writer vibes. I mean, if you remember.
You were just a failed writer.
It was more a case of, back when I was sort of 9, 10, first thinking, oh, I think I might like to write books, I thought that you just rocked up to a publisher if you had a book and they'd be delighted to publish it for you. I had no idea about the logistics of, oh no, you have to actually write something that they want to publish. So, you know, that was a huge letdown when I was sort of about 12 and I suddenly realised the amount of work that went into it.
And yet here you are.
There's a great one that I you know, it's one of those that I've read and I kind of really, really feel it. Yeah, it's one that I can't find the exact copy, but basically it goes, I'm paraphrasing here, goes, "For my father," and then in brackets, "Please feel free to skip the sex scenes." And I'm like, I am all over that. That is how I felt about I Rule the Night. And Dad's like, "Oh, you've just started your fourth book," and I'm like, "Okay,
no."
Like, yeah. If you could just like skip the sex scene or tell me that you skipped it, that would be great.
Obviously, I dedicated the first two books so far in the Hamartia cycle have been dedicated to family members.
Yeah.
And I'm quite pleased with my for the Sons of Thestian and Blood of the Delphi. The Sons of Thestian, it was dedicated to my mother. It said, "You asked me to write you a book without any blood, war, or magic in it. I'm sorry." The second one, and spoilers, was dedicated to my brother, who had a character who is named after him or named for him, who dies in book one. And I said, and it just goes to my brother, "Sorry for killing you in the last book. No hard feelings?" He hasn't responded to that one yet.
Yeah, I dedicated I Am the Silence to my parents, and it's pretty mild, really, but my mum afterwards did then pick up on something that she'd read in the acknowledgements of I Belong to the Earth, because mm-hmm. I wrote, "To Mum and Dad, thanks for all the books." And I've said something in the acknowledgements of I Belong to the Earth where I'm literally saying thank you very much for reading and all the books, etc. But Mum said that I'd phrased it in such a way that it sounded like I was saying that they just sort of left me alone to raise myself next to a mountain of novels. And I'm like, well, that's not quite what I was going for.
And yet I can totally imagine it. Jules was raised.
Jules was raised by a dictionary and a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare.
It explains so much.
I told my mum, I told my mum that you had said to me on the podcast that Jules actually emerged holding a copy of the complete works of Shakespeare. And my mum started laughing and said it bloody well felt like it as well. So there we go. You're all ganging up on me.
It's with love. With love.
Although, of the dedications I've done, my dedication in I Rule the Night is still my favourite.
Which is?
Oh, you should remember that one, Madeline. I'd have to get it off the shelf now.
Yes, but I want it read out loud and I can't reach it from where I am.
Okay, right. Okay, actually getting... okay, breaking things and pulling books down. Okay. For Madeline, co-dragon, writing buddy extraordinaire and friend, thank you for joining me on this journey. Your screams of anguish have made it all worthwhile.
Yes.
I stand by that, by the way.
Thank you. I will have my own back.
Yes, I believe that.
Before we go on, I also want to mention dedications, which are actually part of the story.
Yes.
Now, the series of unfortunate event books, where the author is actually, in fact, a character within the story, Lemony Snicket.
Yes.
Lemony Snicket spends... the entire all of his dedications are in reference to the woman he loved, Beatrice, who's dead.
Yeah.
And the dedications are, they were brilliant as a kid and yet so heartbreaking constantly. And if I just find a some examples, let's see. Okay, all right, so here we've got, "To Beatrice, darling, dearest, dead. For Beatrice, my love for you shall live forever. You, however, did not."
Ouch!
"I would prefer it if you were alive and well." To Beatrice, my love flew like a butterfly until death swooped down like a bat. As the poet Emma Montana McElroy said, that's the end of that. For Beatrice, you will always be in my heart, in my mind, and in your grave. For Beatrice, when we met, my life began. Soon afterwards, yours ended. For Beatrice, when we were together, I felt breathless. Now you are. For Beatrice, summer without you is as cold as winter. Winter without you is even colder. For Beatrice, my love broke my heart and stopped. Sorry, our love broke my heart and stopped yours. For Beatrice, when we first met, you were pretty and I was lonely. Now I am pretty lonely. For Beatrice, dead women tell no tales. Sad men write them down. For Beatrice, no one could extinguish my love or your house.
Oh my God!
For Beatrice, I cherished, you perished. The world's been nightmarish.
Okay.
Yes. And I loved the way that that was done because it's so depressing and yet incredibly funny at the same time.
Yeah, that's a I feel like someone is having far too much fun with their work type. In a really bleak way.
in a very bleak way. And the fact that you can sort of get away with it, I think is the fact that obviously this is not a real character. It's not a real person, and yet it's framed as if it is. And it is part of the narrative. And ultimately, you know, that the whole thing kind of comes together as part of the plot, which I just thought was very clever.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, so I will just go back to epigraphs briefly, because every so often I'll see an epigraph that sort of really resonates with me. And that I talked about a book called Give the Dark My Love, which is all about the class divide, but exploring it through a dark fantasy world where necromancers are forbidden and yet a plague has been set loose through the kingdom. And the epigraph for that particular book was a poem by a chap who I can't actually remember the name of right now, so I'm really sorry. if it comes back to me, I'll say later. But it goes, I loved you as certain dark things were to be loved, secretly between the shadow and the soul. And it really gave a flavour for what sort of came next in the book, with everything being something slightly forbidden and the fact that sometimes you have to break the rules in order to correct the system.
That is a nice touch.
Yes. And obviously, as I've said, I like them myself, partly in my case, certainly with the first four books. They should be the only four books, really. The first four books was that I drew inspiration from 19th century classics. So some of the 19th century classics I've actually quoted a little bit where it's been relevant.
Yes, you certainly have, actually.
And in fairness, that has literally only been really to please myself as much as anything else. But I was very pleased to find out that someone does actually read my author notes and somebody does actually read my epigraphs, and they sort of get something out of it too. So that's great. I'm not the only complete nerd out there.
Well, no, I think I've always liked those additions in books, because they're not just there for the fun of it. And I think that they can help to add an extra layer to the story by simply, you know, incorporating this, what's the word, association, which can be very powerful, actually. I mean, in the same way that you use songs, in particular in I Belong to the Earth, I loved the way that you incorporated folk songs into the story, because even though they didn't actually have relevance to the story itself, they did add that extra dimension. And I think that quoting things and bringing them in does that as well.
Yeah,
so I do like it when authors do that.
Yeah, it's sort of the whole Jane Austen method of bringing in a another strand in the chain of association, and someone can read over it and still get the entire story, and someone can read that bit and think, oh, that makes me think of X, Y, and Z, and it just gives, as you say, an extra dimension. And I think I did that sort of instinctively with I Belong to the Earth, and then did it much more consciously with I Rule the Night, because obviously there's an entire subplot involving folk songs there.
So music is quite important there.
And I have to admit, I couldn't find folk songs that were completely perfectly what I wanted for some of it, so I adapted some, I borrowed a few others, and a couple of others I just sort of wrote from scratch. And even though that you only see like the tiniest part of it, it's sort of true to the idea of a folk song, but it fitted much more accurately with the story.
Yeah.
So it would make you think of the sort of subject matter of the folk songs, but technically they hadn't existed before I'd sort of freaked around with them. So that's always good fun. I keep thinking, actually, that I might just type them up properly and put them on my website for anyone nerdy enough to want to see them.
I think you should. I think that there are nerds out there who will want to see them.
Or, you know, people who just want that little bit of extra. But we'll get on to that in a moment. Let's talk about footnotes, because the very word footnote should make you think of, oh god, all those textbooks I had to read at university. The fact that I had to like reference everything and go back and check. And yet they have been used really, really cleverly by fiction authors.
Yes.
To tell sort of, if you like, a sub-story. So let's take Watership Down by Richard Adams. The footnotes in Watership Down start off, I think the first time I tried to read Watership Down, I was about 7, and I was clearly way too young to read that book. And I didn't finish it on that occasion.
Yeah, that's terrifying.
But when I went back to it when I was 10, and part of the reason I didn't finish it the first time round was the footnotes kept distracting me and I couldn't understand how they fitted in. When I went back to it when I was 10, and then when I reread it as a teenager and started taking in the footnotes, I realised it was telling a kind of parallel story. And then by the time you get to the end of the book, you realise that Richard Adams has taught you the rabbit language using the footnotes.
Oh my god.
Which is really, really clever. So he'll throw a word like Lendry into the book in general, and then it'll say, oh, footnote one, you go down and say Lendry is a fox or whatever. That's a really, really simple version of it, but it tells you all about the rabbit mythology and, you know, their sort of their religious beliefs as well, if you like, if you want to call it religion. And yeah, once again, as I've said before, Silfle Hraku Uemble Ra, which is what Bigwig says to Woundwort at the end, is one of the best bits of deceptive swearing in a children's book ever, because he's literally saying, eat shit, you fucking tyrant. Which, you know, if you've been reading the footnotes, because there is no footnote for that one, it doesn't translate it for you. It assumes you've been reading the footnotes all the way through and learning Lapine, the rabbit language, and that by the time you get to that bit, you can translate that with no problem whatsoever. So it's awesome. I find that really, really clever, and it did for me add another dimension to the book. And
that is very, very clever.
Yeah. And then there's things like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Suzanne Clarke. And initially I think when I saw the size of those footnotes, some of them are like 3.5 pages long, I was kind of like, oh god, this, what can you possibly have put in a footnote that you couldn't put in the main story? But as it turns out, it gives you a lot of background information to the actual story, and they're really entertaining little self-contained reads in their own right, and I really enjoyed them.
Because I haven't read that. Was I've seen Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, and obviously it's a slightly different story, the television series that they did of it. But I haven't properly read the book itself, and I have been told about the footnotes. Footnotes have always been interesting to me, because I think the first time I really came across them was probably the children's book series, and I've just forgot the name, and I literally noted it down for myself, The Amulet of, with, oh,
That's not
Sorry.
The Amulet of Samarkand.
Samarkand, yes. And I'm almost certain that the Amulet of Samarkand uses footnotes as well.
Oh, right.
The Bartimaeus trilogy. And I think they do. And the reason I say I think is because, again, I didn't read it, but I listened to it. And there were moments which seemed to be footnotes, and it's been a while since I listened to them. I think it was the first time I came across this idea of these little asides,
yeah,
where everything would be, you would just be taken to the side and have something explained to you, which would add a kind of a depth to the world, or to what was happening. And I'm almost certain it was the Bartimaeus trilogy, but it's been so long, I might be wrong. And I was always a little bit wary of it, because on the one side, I think it's a brilliant idea, interesting, and I would be intrigued by trying to try and do it myself in some form or another. On the other side, I am wary of it, because if you don't do it right, you basically just interrupt the flow of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what makes... I'm the same as you. When I've seen it done well, I've gone, I'd kind of like to have a go at that because that looks really fun. But on the other hand, if it's not done right, as you say, you've just kicked the reader out of the story, and every time they get back into it, you kick them out again. The other one I saw that was done right was Nevernight, whereby you've got a very present third-person narrator. So he or she is third-person omniscient, and you're obviously in Mia's head for pretty much all of the story. However, every so often, the narrator pulls back and you realise this is actually someone telling you the story, really telling you. And this person has a personality of their own. And they sort of fade in and out as you go through the book. But the footnotes in that are interesting as well. Because I initially read it on Kindle, I skipped the footnotes for the first third of the book and then thought... The way footnotes are done in a Kindle are you would just click on the highlighted bit of text where there's a footnote, and it takes you to the footnote and then it takes you back again, which is really clever. So you can just not read them if you want to. And I kind of wish that I'd actually read the footnotes because they're hilarious. They're really funny. This is little snide asides by this third person, very present, characterful narrator who you never really know who it is, or you certainly don't yet. I'm hoping we get to find out by the end of the third book, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, there's been theories. I personally think it's the cat.
At different points, I've thought it's been the cat. I've thought it's been, you know, one of the love interests. I've thought it's been the other one. I've thought, oh, God, maybe it's Mia herself, you know. And she's sort of like doing this weird sort of, yes, this is me. Wasn't I a stupid girl kind of thing? I don't know, but I'm looking forward to finding out. But those ones really worked for me as well. So footnotes can be a great way of giving extra depth and more dimension to a story, or as you said, Madeline, they could completely derail the entire story and make your book basically unreadable.
Yeah, and it is about finding that balance, I think. Between the problem is that for me, I really struggle to read anyway, despite I love to read and, you know, I can gobble down books. Because of my dyslexia, the way I read makes having little asides like that very, very difficult for me to handle, which may actually also be why I struggle to get into Nevernight, among other things as well. What I like to imagine is that if a book completely relies on people reading those notes, then you've got a problem.
Yes.
Which is that they're not footnotes. They are part of the story. So don't put them as footnotes. If the footnotes only simply add something to it, but don't really matter that much in terms of being able to comprehend the plot, then that's fine, because in that way, actually, it can be quite pleasurable to go through the first time and not have the foot, and then to go through the second time and kind of have a companion who you're reading it with, talking about it with you as you go along.
Yeah, definitely. No, I completely agree. And you're absolutely right. If the footnotes aren't basically little additions or telling a sub-story that you don't desperately need, but that you might enjoy, but are actually part of the main plot, then they should be in with the main plot, because otherwise that's bad structure.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, let's talk a bit about maps.
Yay!
I suppose for me, maps are kind of an indulgence because at the moment, or rather, I haven't released any epic fantasy yet. Everything has kind of been set in our world, and I haven't really needed to produce a map. I do love maps in books, particularly fantasy worlds and things, but because, once again, I mostly read via ebook, it's something I haven't been able to indulge in. Having said that, I did just buy the hardback copy of Samantha Shannon's The Priory of the Orange Tree, which has any number of like appendices and maps and character lists and pronunciation guides, and I just love all of it because I love the book.
Yeah, I mean, I love maps in books. And I know of lots of readers who will literally track journeys on maps as things are happening in the stories. So much so that here's an example of actually a map that's not, or rather not a map that's gone wrong, but a map which has picked up an inconsistency. And that is in one of the A Court of Thorns and Roses books.
I didn't know they even had maps. Again, ebooks.
They do. They have maps at the front. They have these beautiful maps, which are really lovely, which show how the courts are all split. Except, in my mind, first of all, I imagined them split differently, or rather, I always thought spring and not spring, summer and autumn were in opposite places, in that I thought that autumn was to the northwest while summer was to the northeast.
Yeah.
But it's actually, I think, the other way around on the map, which confused the hell out of me. And then there is a moment in the book where Feyre's talking about the fact that she can't go too much toward the toward the west or to, whereas I might have gotten the way rounds completely, but she says I can't go too much toward that toward the west, otherwise I'll end up in towards the east, because otherwise I'll end up in summer territory.
Yeah,
she's going through autumn, and according to the map, that's entirely wrong. If she goes that direction, she ends up in the sea. Because the court is actually literally in the other direction. Now, this could be excused because Feyre's sort of illiterate. Well, she's not at this point, but you know, she hasn't been in the world long. She might have just got her geography entirely wrong. Unfortunately, I'm almost certain she's got Lucian with her, who would probably be like, nah, pretty sure I know where the courts are, as I've been round to all of them. So a lot of people picked up on that, because you had readers who would go like, right, I'm going to track their journey and hold on a second.
See, all I'm hearing here is like, Jules, if you ever write epic fantasy, you need to do your own map. You cannot farm that shit out because you need to pick up any inconsistency.
Yeah, but I think the other thing is that maps are great, and everyone loves the kind of visual, but for those who are really into their geography, if you're doing your own map, you suddenly go, right, how far is thing from each other?
How much
distance? Because that is something you really have to then think about. So actually, it can be quite useful to draw a map before you start having your characters travel anywhere, because I tell you, readers and fans will notice, for instance, the obscene amount of criticism I've seen for Game of Thrones because of the fact that Peter Baelish was able to get from the capital from you know, the capital of Westeros up to the north in like a matter of days, and they were like, nah, it should have taken him weeks, look how far apart they are. Which just means that, yeah, apparently he could teleport. Who knew? Peter Baelish. Peter Baelish knew. Anyway. The moment there's a visual component, on the one side, it's great because it means that people can see it, they can track it. And also, I think we just like maps. Even if we can't read them, we like maps. We like the way they look. We like having a general idea of direction and sense, and also going, oh, so there's a forest there, and oh, there's a river, and it's really lovely. But also, it means that if you haven't done your due diligence, which can be very difficult to do, and even, I struggle with it when I was doing the map for Hamartia, and someone very smart will probably be able to say, hold on a second, un minuten bitte, this is not accurate. People can pick up inconsistencies. My excuse, if anyone does pick me up on it, and I'll say, oh, well, you see, it's a map drawn of the era of the time. They're not that great with distances and stuff like that. You look at old maps and they have no idea how things work. So that's my excuse.
Yeah, and the Mirithian Forest basically changes its dimensions every 5 minutes. So.
It's like, and also, it's like, why does it only take them a few minutes? Fairies, fairies. Fairies let them go through quickly. Other fairies don't. Who knows? It's magic. Don't question.
Yeah, I have to. No, I completely agree with you. And if you're writing something that the bigger something gets, the harder it becomes to both keep the timeline straight and the distance straight. So I do have sympathy, but I have to say that's the sort of error that I wouldn't forgive myself. So I would be so anally retentive about that. I'd probably give myself a breakdown. Oh God, the kind of stress I put myself through when I discover a typo. Everybody has typos, okay? I've literally just read Stephen King's It for about like the eighth time, and I've discovered four typos on that going through. And obviously, that book's been out for about a good 30 years, and this was something like the sixth edition of it. So, these things happen. Typos creep in. Readers don't really care that much, but.
Yeah.
But
Sorry. Just a small aside. This is me putting a footnote in the episode, not relevant to the episode, but you saying that you're reading it the other night when Jules and I were talking, and she said she'd been reading Stephen King before bed, and we had a long conversation about the fact that of all of the authors, Jules, who has, guts of iron and is never scared, Stephen King can scare Jules, and yet he is the one that she chose. She thought, you know what I'm gonna do right before bed? I'm gonna read the only author on earth who can scare me. What could possibly go wrong?
In fairness, Phil Rickman has scared me more. And I did have pretty weird epic dreams that a murderous killer clown did turn up in. So these things happen. My brain decides to torment me from time to time.
Anyway, footnote aside, back to the episode.
Back to the episode. Okay, so let's think about other extras for the last 10 minutes or so. So, things like cast lists, pronunciation guides, I keep getting asked by readers to produce a timeline and put it on my website. And the more they hear about us talking about our shared universe on Dissecting Dragons and where I've mentioned it in my newsletter, Madeline, it's kind of like, you are going to do a timeline when you two like really properly join up, aren't you? As in, increasing levels of stridency are coming through, and I'm like, no, I really will, honestly, guys, I promise. I will do a timeline.
We've already started to put it together. Okay, guys, don't worry. There will be a timeline. We will explain. I mean, the Hamartia Cycle website is literally there because it is full of extra stuff, including questionnaires to find out what star you'd be born under in the world, which night patrol form you'd take. Extra little bits about history, folklore, slang, and it is all there because I am a giant nerd and I can't fit all of it into the book. And I just want people to be able to escape somewhere and just kind of immerse themselves in the world and pick it up and feel like they're there and that it's all around them.
Yeah, definitely. At the moment, I've kind of got away with not adding. I think I might add some of the stuff to my website, but basically, I've sort of tucked things like Kieran's Guide to Irish Slang in the back of his novella, in the back of Betwixt and Between, and pronunciation guides in the books that are relevant. The problem is, I kind of feel I need to add a pronunciation guide for some things because I keep including bits of all these old Celtic languages.
Yes, you do. I had to add pronunciation guides in Hamartia as well, but that's mostly because my general spelling for character names is proportionately disruptive for any epic fantasy.
I have to say, if it's if it's an author I care about and I really like what they've produced, I will go and look at their website, and I'm always happy to see like little bits of extra stuff. I might not religiously read all of it, but I'll go and check it out. And if I like their website, I'll go back again. Part of that is me being another author, and it's like, well, how do you do it? I want to see if that's something I could apply to my own work, and that's certainly something I've done with newsletters, which I'm finally getting the hang of, I think.
No, I agree, and it's also interesting as well because in this new world of social media, having things like Pinterest and being able to go to see an author's board and see the collection of pictures that they've put together to inspire them, and see that itself, that's a nice little extra thing to be able to see. And also authors who put together playlists on Spotify and stuff like that, or write down music which inspired them for certain scenes. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love
I have
it.
to admit, that's another thing I get asked for, is playlists. What were you listening to? And I'm like, okay, I will get back to you on that. I promise. I know exactly what I was listening to. I might have to join Spotify at this rate, and then add those things. But I like things like, authors, some authors will put up little cartoons. I love visiting Shannon Maguire's site because she has an entire songbook of Filk songs that she's written, and some of them are about her work, and some of them are about things like Firefly or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So it's all nerdy stuff I really like, and turns out I really like her music as well. So that was a really nice thing to discover. It's something that she does more of as a hobby than anything else. But I really enjoyed that. It was nice to have an author who was sort of, this is something I enjoy and I'm happy to share it with you. So I don't feel like I know her very well or anything, but if you really like and admire an author, it's always nice to go and find something like that. So this is my thing. I'm going to stop being a bit quite so guarded and assume that people won't actually want to see what I do for fun, kind of thing,
No,
and
we do.
add more stuff to my website.
No, I really enjoy. Obviously, I've drawn a fair bit for Hamartia Cycle, and I've written music for Hamartia Cycle as well, which is available either on my author website or the Hamartia Cycle website itself. And I'm not claiming to be Mozart or or Leonardo da Vinci, but it's just there to show where my head was at. And another thing I really like doing is that I've been very blessed to have had some fan work which has been done by people, and to be able to share that too. It means a lot to me, and I think that it should be celebrated and that these little extras do add dimension to the story. So I really like, especially when I go to another author's website and they're like, yeah, these are my drawings, or look, I've designed the clothes, or here's the floor plan to the house where everything is set. I like little extra things like that. It's just nice.
Yeah, definitely. So I enjoy all of those. I quite like the odd deleted scene or the odd alternate ending, depending on what it is. And sometimes I like scenes from other characters' points of view. And these are all things that I just do automatically anyway, but I don't share a lot of them with other people.
Except for me,
Except for you.
because I creep up on you.
Well, you ask me what I'm doing. I'm like, well, I'm just having a look at this. And you're like, oh, can I see it too? I'm like, oh, I suppose so. Yes, but I mean, I've been very disparaging in the past, particularly at A Court of Frost and Starlight, which to
Yes.
me read like it without me throwing verbal beanie babies again, it read like honestly, it read like the collection of scenes that you write as an author to comfort yourself when you've really traumatized your characters. And I was just kind of like, I know that I was really sort of like, I have all those scenes, but I keep them to myself. I don't expect people to pay $7.99 for them. And then a few readers came forward and said, actually, could you put those in a book? Because we would pay $7.99 for them. And honestly, I cannot charge you that because they're just not worth it. But I might add them to my website and you can look at them at your leisure if they're not too terrible. There was a reason these things were cut out of the books, in fairness. They didn't fit, they didn't work. But
But I still like them. And at the end of the day, I also liked A Court of Frost and Starlight.
and
Or,
that
as you call it, a court of shopping and sex.
obviously Madeline's opinion on that is as valid as mine, and possibly more valid because she's still very much a fan, whereas I'm literally just hanging on for Nesta and Lucian.
You must understand, I am also pretty much hanging on for Lucian. But I'm invested.
So basically, I kind of had to eat my words on that one. I still feel how I feel about that novella, but on the other hand, you know what? If you produce something that readers really love, then who is it for me to say whether something's got value or not if you want the extra scenes that don't, in my opinion, add very much? And it's kind of the same with my work as well. It's like these extra scenes I don't really add anything, but if you want to see, I don't know, Kelsey and Craig and Kieran hanging out and having a hot chocolate, then fine.
I do want to see these things.
The only thing I'm not going to share is the smut.
Oh, but now you've told people there is smut.
Well, if I wrote smut, I wouldn't be sharing
Jules. Jules, you've already exposed yourself.
In fairness, there are a couple of sex scenes that didn't make it into books anyway, and they shouldn't
Yes.
have done because it wasn't adding anything to the story. But sometimes you need to write something in order to get past a certain scene, as it were. She says, making excuses.
Excuses. See, this is the nice thing about being friends with an author. You get to see the things that nobody else does. Right. I think we've run out of time, Jules.
We have run out of time. I just want one final note about author newsletters. I follow a few of them, and to start with, I followed like loads because I wanted to see how people put their newsletters together. And then over time, I gradually unsubscribed from the ones that weren't interesting me. And it came to me that the ones that I stayed with were the ones where the author just talked to you like a person and told you a bit about what they were doing and what they were working on, and maybe shared some of their interests and things like that. And those ones I anticipate eagerly. And it's something that I've tried to do with my own newsletter going forward, and I've had a lot more reader engagement from it as well. So I'm curious, really, from listeners, and you, obviously, Madeline, as you know, what makes you stick with an author newsletter? Do you follow a lot of them? Or does it not really interest you? Would you rather only interact with your authors through books?
I think it depends. I don't follow a lot of author newsletters, to be honest, because I think that for the most part, there's a kind of a level of promotion there. I guess it's probably because there are very few authors with whom I'm like, yes, I will read whatever you are writing. I'm usually more a series fan or a particular book fan, and it's only very much in kind of recent years that I've started to think of, oh no, okay, I really like the style of this particular author, and I will probably read everything that they write. Now, obviously, in the case of Jules, I love everything that you write. So I am invested in whatever you have to say. I'm invested in any of the news that you bring forward. I am also, however, your friend, which means that I usually hear most things and get to read most things before you send them out in your newsletter.
Yeah, you don't really need to be following that, do you?
No. But I think certainly for fans out there, having that more personal feel in a newsletter makes a difference. I mean, and if you think of it in the same way that when one is running a Twitter or a Facebook page, more engagement if you are not just constantly advertising your work.
Yeah, totally.
People are there for the person, okay? They want little bits and bobs. Now, it might be that certain authors have taken that a little bit too far. J.K. Rowling. But at the same time, I don't really blame J.K. Rowling for what she's done. I think there's an issue there that she's completely not realizing what's happened. But in terms of adding, continuing the world building, I think you should be allowed to do that, and I think you should be allowed to sort of bring out more information as you go. And actually, I also think that there are actually quite a few fans who like that and who like being given little asides and told little things, not just about the books, but about life in general. And I particularly like it when authors can become part of a joke. For instance, I tweeted Scott Lynch, who is the author of The Lies of Locke Lamora.
Yeah.
I tweeted him a video from a game where I don't actually I can't video game or it's a computer game where you and a crew are on a boat and you sail across the sea and I assume you're pirate. And there's just this fantastic little clip. You can find it on my Twitter, but this fantastic little clip of just these people, they're sailing away and then one of them goes, "Captain!" He goes, "What?" And he looks around and there's this huge pirate ship that's coming speeding towards sort of ramming into the side and the next sort of minute is just them going, "Oh shit, fuck." And what happened was that I was reading Red Seas Under Red Skies and I was listening to the audiobook at the same time. And every time in the audiobook they would say, "Captain," and they'd call out, all I could think about was that video of the pirate ship. And it became ingrained in me that that was basically Red Seas Under Red Skies. Locke sort of commandeers a ship for a little bit and is captain for a grand total of a few days before everything goes terribly wrong. And basically that's how I imagine it in my head. So I tweeted it to Scott Lynch, who seemed to enjoy it quite a lot and said, "I have to use that line, shit, fuck, no, we've got so much stuff in one of my future books."
Awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, I do think that author putting a little bit of themselves out there and being kind of open, and also not acting as if they're cold toward their own books, but being warm and appreciative of everything that is happening and showing that makes a difference. And I think that, yeah, that's what people want.
I would completely agree with that. And we have definitely reached the end of the episode now.
Well, before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, I've just finished reading A Skinful of Shadows by Frances Harding. Frances Harding won the, I want to say the basically the Children's Literature Prize for The Lie Tree, which I haven't actually read. But A Skinful of Shadows is about she starts off as a 12-year-old girl. Her name is Makepeace Lightfoot, and this is in the early 1600s, so right before the war, the civil war between Cromwell and Charles I. So it's set at a historical background, but really the story is all about Makepeace finding out who her father's family are, because her mother ran away with ran away when she was pregnant with Makepeace, and for the first 12 years of Makepeace's life, won't tell her anything about her father's family, etc., etc. There's lots of other things that are going on. There's a weird sort of paranormal setting to the book as well, as in Makepeace finds she's very sensitive to ghosts, and her mother, once Makepeace turns 12, she starts basically shutting Makepeace up in a graveyard at nights if the night is warm enough, and leaving her there. And of course the ghosts start attacking Makepeace, so she learns to defend herself against them, but she hates it. Quite understandably, she's frightened. Yeah. She's terrified by these confused and vengeful ghosts that, for some reason, are drawn to her. And her mother's sort of like, "No, it's for your own good. I'm teaching you how to defend yourself, basically." Before her mother can explain any further, though, her mother dies, and Makepeace finds herself back with her father's family. And everything gradually becomes clear. So it sort of flips back and forth against the backdrop of the Civil War and Makepeace having to deal with this family that has some very, very dark secrets indeed. And it's a really, really good book. Very cleverly plotted. And I think there's some really good character development as by the end of the book, Makepeace is nearly 16 and she's stopped being a child, and she's realizing that some of the things that were done were bad, but they were done with the right sort of intentions, if you like.
Yeah.
So I recommend that one.
Okay. That sounds really, really interesting.
It's good.
On that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.